Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order January 24th, 2022. With me today is Co-Chair Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, myself, Stedman. We've got Senator Olson calling in. He'll be online. I guess there's been some plane delays, so we may be joined by other members later. But today we're going to continue our presentation from the Office of Management and Budget, which is the executive branch's financial arm. And the director is going to come forward and jump in the hot seat, pick us up where he left off on slide 9. We'll continue through the agencies. After Mr. Steininger is done, he's the OMB director, then we will go to the regular scheduled portion of the meeting, which is presentation from legislative finance. And there's no intent here to rush either one of these two presenters. We'll take the time necessary for committee members' questions and discussions. And if we run over on time, we will go ahead and continue with legislative finance tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock until we finish up. That'll be the plan. These are important meetings as we lay the groundwork, historic groundwork down for the discussion of the budget that we're going to be working on the next 3 months. So with that, Mr. Steininger, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record, remind the committee what you do and the public, and then pick us up on slide number 9, at the beginning of slide 9, please.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Neil Steininger. I'm the director of the Office of Management and Budget. So here in slide 9, I covered this on Friday, but I'll just give a real quick recap of what we're looking at here. This table is an attempt to provide a summary of broad categories of changes in the fiscal year 23 agency operating budgets. So from a baseline of the FY22 management plan, which is the budget enacted by the legislature for fiscal year 22 post veto or fiscal notes. So basically the budget available to agencies in fiscal year 22. And then this is a high level summary of the $13.9 million in net additions going into fiscal year 23. In broad categories, we have about $108 million in cost drivers. Some of these are adjustments from one-time fund source uses in the fiscal year 22 budget in the Department of Transportation. For the next, at least this year and the following year, you'll see some of these changes as we unwind use of federal funds in the Department of Transportation operating budget where we were able to save UGF. We also have an increase in the Medicaid program. I'll go into a bit more detail on that in the next slide. Other adjustments for salaries or central services rates charged between departments, and the impact of the CBR sweep. We had to backfill unrestricted general fund spending into agencies where designated general funds were swept into the CBR. And the next large category is agency reductions, the biggest of which is use of federal money to support the Alaska Marine Highway System. There's a fairly significant federal program that's new that was included in the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act that allows us to support that system with federal dollars, eliminating the need for a significant portion of the state dollars used in that system. We also have some changes in the Department of Education formula, as well as our contributions to PERS and TERS, the Public Employee Retirement System and Teachers Retirement System, as a result of good market returns. And then a handful of targeted savings. We also have some targeted investments, primarily in public protection, as well as resource development and primacy.
Okay. So we'll go to Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned under the built-in cost drivers, the restoration of funds under the sweep impacts. What funds did you not restore the funds to that were swept?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the $33.6 million is to ensure any programs that were funded with swept funds have access to full funding in fiscal year 23. So there weren't any that we chose not to restore in terms of the, you know, providing unrestricted unrestricted general fund to the underlying programs. So things like the scholarship program, where the higher education fund was swept, we put money into the Department of Education budget to pay for those scholarships with unrestricted general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm well aware of that. My question is not what programs are continued, but what funds have been restored because of the sweep. Were there any funds that were not fully restored, and what are they?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the budget proposal put forward by the administration does not include a reversal of the sweep. Rather than reversing the sweep in this budget would leave that money in the constitutional budget reserve and instead support those programs with unrestricted general fund. So none of those swept funds are restored in this budget.
Again, Mr. Chairman, what are those funds that were not fully restored?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, we can provide you a list. That list will be included in the state's annual financial reports. There's a couple dozen funds, the largest of which is the Higher Education Investment Fund. That's about $400 million. The total across all the funds is about $490 million.
Thank you for that answer. That was not very hard, was it?
So on that subject, before we go to Senator Wilson's question, we have requested a legal opinion on the accounting interpretation from the executive branch. Some of us feel that it is an error and won't pass muster. We have to pass muster, meaning it won't survive an audit and being signed off by the in our annual financial statement. So we're waiting for that, and we're also waiting then for the audit to come out, and then we'll be having hearings on this subject matter. I expect one of two paths. One is it passes the accounting red face test and signed off by the auditors. It'll be a fairly short meeting then. I think that's unlikely, in my opinion. And then we will take a look at all those accounts individually, Senator Hoffman, one by one, and we'll have a conversation with the auditors. My expectation is we'll be in front of the third branch of government called the courts to straighten this out, because we'll wait and see what happens. But that's the two courses of actions. And we're kind of stuck in the mud right now, waiting for the audit to be done. And it's coming. We should have it on the table here within a month, I would think, 3 weeks or so. And that legal work has already been submitted to Ledge Legal, and it's underway. So we'll be reporting back to the committee members through the process, and any of you wants updates along the way, just let my office know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steinger, on the Alaska Marine Highway funds, can you remind me about how much of towards federal funding will be targeted toward the Marine Highway and how many years that will last?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, so I can't give an exact number. There's, you know, several different places in the infrastructure bill where Marine Highway System funding will come through, and some of it we have more detail on than others. The portion that allows us to offset the unrestricted general fund you see here on this slide is a $200 million per year program for 5 years for rural ferry systems. That's a national level number. However, there's only two ferry systems in the nation that qualify for that. And so, you know, our understanding is Alaska will see a large share of that $200 million, much in excess of the 63.4. So we're expecting, you know, at least half, if not more, of that $200 million. And that is for 5 years.
Right. So, then are we expecting to have this reduction for the $63 million for those 5 years, or
Is that just going to be for a few years, or?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, these savings would be here for as long as that federal program stays in place. It's currently authorized for 5 years. If it was reauthorized in another 5 years, you know, you'd continue to see federal support rather than state support. So this provides an opportunity over that time to continue to collect the fare box, you know, the fees, ridership fees in the ferry system, and, you know, build up support for that system and transition and, you know, make improvements to the system over time.
Okay, thank you.
So on that, we'll have future hearings on the infrastructure bill and the impacts across the state. The Marine Highway is one area that gets significantly impacted, as referenced by your questions. There is a couple of concerns. One is at the end of the five-year cycle, if there is no reoccurring revenue coming out of the feds, what position does that put the Marine Highway in if it needs an $80 million general fund appropriation or some number? That would be a very high hurdle to try to get over, I think, in the future for them. So there's some concerns there. Also, there's concerns about the fare box and what's going to happen to it. In other words, if it's swept every year or what have you, how do we deal with that? So we'll have to sort through this issue going forward and make sure we understand the risk and benefits of it when we decide to whatever structure we decide here at the committee to put forward. Also, there's a new board put together. It'll be nice to see what they have to say and have some input there, too. Those are good questions, Senator Wilson. Any other questions on number 9? Okay, move on to number 10, please.
So moving to slide 10, we're looking at the main formula cost drivers to state operating budgets. That's K-12 education and the Medicaid program. In K-12 education, we do see a decline of about $19 million in the state contribution coming out of the formula. This is fully funding the formula to the $5,930 base student allocation. The change really comes from the inputs of student counts and student demographics. So you have a continued reduction of just under 700 ADM, which is average daily membership, for regular or brick-and-mortar schooling. And an increase of a little bit under 600 ADM for correspondence. Correspondence students in the formula are funded slightly different than brick and mortar because, as you can imagine, you know, it's slightly different costs involved in educating a correspondence student. So the net impact of that is a reduction in the general fund need for K-12 education based on the formula. In the Medicaid program, we have a couple other, you know, kind of complicating factors to Medicaid this year. So during the pandemic, we've been receiving an enhanced federal participation or an enhanced FMAP for Medicaid. That currently will be expiring at the end of this fiscal year if it's not extended by the federal government. So as a result of that expiration, the state share percentage increases. We've also seen a bit of pent-up demand for services that have increased utilization. Between those factors, netted with some cost savings initiatives around looking at the number of people on Medicaid, we have a total $45 million UGF increment that brings the Medicaid program back up to projected levels into next year.
Okay, so we have a few questions here. We'll start with Senator Bishop. We'll go to Senator Wilson. And then Senator Hoffman.
Just briefly, I just want to bring it up again. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, I know the boarding school formula is outside of the BSA, but have you had any conversation with the boarding schools around the state? I have, and their deficit spending to the tune of about 100%. That hasn't been updated since about 2015. Have you guys thought about coming out with legislation to make them whole on their boarding school costs?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I personally haven't had any conversations with the boarding schools. One thing I can say is we do have one expansion of a residential school in the budget. It's a smaller dollar value increment, but I would defer to the Department of Education with kind of more detailed questions on the cost going into boarding schools.
Thank you.
And I've had that concern expressed in my office also, so we'll dig into that as we go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions on both topics here. First, education. last year, I asked that question about the disparity funding and tests to make sure that we weren't going to fail that disparity funding, and we may have a failure in that funding. Can you talk about that?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, the Department of Education is currently working with both the Department of Law and an outside party to discuss with U.S. Department of Education the disparity test. Currently, we're working on a alternative calculation to meet the disparity test. There are some questions from, you know, kind of changes into interpretation of, you know, the way that it had been done for 30 years was changed by U.S. Department of Education, and so we're, you know, responding and looking at the calculation. We'll have more information on whether U.S. Department of Education accepts a revised calculation sometime in mid to late February, and you know, based on that information, we'll look at next steps for the state. Right now, though, you know, we're confident in, you know, looking at how other states have responded to similar questions and how we're responding, and we're fairly confident in what we're putting forward.
If I could.
Could you help us a little bit with what is a disparity test and why the committee should be paying attention to this and what kind of dollar amounts we're possibly looking at, and explain it, you know, so those that are watching the meeting understand what the issue is.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Yes. So the disparity test, there are school districts that receive what's called federal impact aid, and that's about $70 to $73 million that's received by those districts. And in order to count that federal impact aid as a portion of K-12 state funding to the districts, we have to meet a disparity test, and that is effectively ensuring that the lowest funded districts and the highest funded districts don't have too much disparity between their funding. I'll leave that explanation about there so I don't get a little bit too out of school, pardon the pun, and defer any more detailed questions to the Department of Education on that. But the question to Senator Wilson's question, you know, for 30 years the calculation was done in one way by the U.S. Department of Education, and that shifted last year, and they looked at different costs and applied different costs to that disparity metric that previously hadn't been considered. And under that, you know, shifted interpretation, it changed the way that you see disparity in our education calculations. And so we're working with USDOE to look at how that calculation is made and the changes in that calculation to ensure that it accurately represents, you know, the differences in funding in Alaska compared to other states in the nation and the factors that go into that.
So if we flow in the 70 million, round it off, what should we expect as far as winners and losers, as far as concentration where that funds would go under the new interpretation?
Chair Stedman, you know, I'd have to defer that, you know, the exact district by district impacts to Department of Education. They could provide that information, but I will reiterate that we are, you know, confident in our path forward on, you know, the interpretation of the disparity test. You know, we don't believe that the reinterpretation is necessarily, you know, taking into consideration unique factors in Alaska that aren't present in other states.
Okay, so what we'll do, I think, here is we'll have the Department of Ed come in, give us a presentation on this subject so the committee understands if the new interpretation prevails, what the consequences are, and if it doesn't, you know, what the status quo is, and or some hybrid in between, so we can understand the full impact of this issue. It's large. Mm-hmm. At 77 million. You have a follow-up, Senator Wilson?
Yeah, just on that one, Mr. Chair, is that I asked that question because of that large number, and we were assured that that wasn't going to be an issue. So I hope we can prevail.
My other question has to do with the Medicaid FMAP, the enhanced federal match. Is there any talks within the federal delegation of that being continued for our state in any type of way?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the most recent extension was earlier this month, and in that extension they stated that they give, I believe it was 60 days warning before it expired. So there's, that indicates to me that they're contemplating extending it further at the federal level, so that would apply to all states. I'd defer a little bit to the Department of Health and Social Services on, any direct conversations they may be having about Alaska's baseline federal participation rate. But in terms of this enhanced FMAP, there is, some likelihood that it may get extended again. And if that does, we'll have to look at our Medicaid projections with that new match rate and, come back to, the committee with a revised, Medicaid projection.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
I'll pass. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions on this? Go ahead and continue.
So slide 11 is a portion of our public protection targeted investments in the fiscal year 23 budget. So we have over $30 million in operating budget unrestricted general fund increments and additions for public protection. First, we've fully funded the filled positions that have been added in previous fiscal years. So oftentimes when new positions or a large number of new positions are added, they're not necessarily fully funded just in consideration of the time it takes to recruit and hire. And so here you'll see $1.3 million spread across public safety and law, where that hiring has been able to take place and the positions need to be fully funded. We've also added 15 new trooper positions. The department has been engaging in recruitment activities rather aggressively, and it's been showing some success, and they have much more full trooper classes than they have in the past. Adding more trooper slots will allow them to continue that aggressive recruitment activity. We've also added 10 new village public safety officers, well, the related costs, and given a 5% salary adjustment to the existing and the future village public safety officers to try to help with recruitment and retention. It's not all just direct public safety law enforcement. We're also adding support positions. Often there's a lot more attention given to the direct public safety, law enforcement badged trooper positions, but they do require a lot of support on the back end so that they can focus on policing. These are in areas like, aircraft maintenance or back of house positions, and it's about $1.8 million total. In other areas of public protection, we have investments in both rural fire investigation in public safety as well as in DNR wildland firefighting capacity, totaling $4.5 million. In correctional systems, we've added we've added 30 support positions, including a mental health treatment unit and a new booking unit at Highland Mountain, totaling $4.1 million. And we have some investments trying to address the trial backlogs that have, increased over the period of the pandemic. That's $1.8 million, as well as a little over $400,000 for defense capacity.
We have questions? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Director, can you provide my office with the locations of the 59 new positions that are being added, the 15 new trooper positions, the 14 support positions for the troopers, and the 30 correctional institution support positions to see, so I can get an understanding of how these positions are spread throughout the state of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And maybe share that with the chairman's office so we can keep track of Senator Hoffman and his request. If you could send that to the committee. We've had several committee members concerned about the allocation of these resources around the state, and I'd like to particularly have us take a look at the village public safety officers issue to see if that is a significant enough change to make an impact, and we can talk about that here at the committee. Senator Bishop. Wilson was first. If Wilson, then we'll go to Bishop. Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was about the Bill of Safety, Village Public Safety Officers. In the past, I think 5 years, this positions that were vacant were never filled. And so are these additional 10 positions on top of the unfulfilled positions that we currently have? And if so, why aren't we looking at putting this money toward a better recruitment retention process to fill those open vacant positions?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, this is an addition of 10 new effectively slots for village public safety officers. So, you know, in the past when they haven't been able to fill some, we've had lapsed money in this program, but the department is kind of renewing their efforts to support this program and help the organizations recruit and retain. I mentioned the 5% salary adjustment. You know, that's really trying to, you know, support the individuals that are already in these positions as well as attract new individuals in. So this is an addition of 10 new on top of what already existed. I definitely would encourage, you know, the committee and the members of the committee to talk to the department about their kind of new outlook on how they're trying to address the issue of recruitment and retention, you know, not just with troopers, but also with village public safety officers. There's a lot of energy being put into, you know, trying to ensure that these positions do get filled and that the individuals stay in the positions.
Right. And if I
before we go to the next question, back on Senator Hoffman's point about getting back to the committee, I think, Senator Hoffman, when we get that response back, we should have the Department of Law come forward to the committee and talk about the issue that U.S. Attorney General here 2 years ago or so was very concerned about rural Alaska and the disparity there. And we can have those conversations when we look at these budget increments to make sure that that is being focused on to a degree that is comfortable with the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, on the last bullet, I see you're adding $428,000 for defense capacity. Is that in the Public Defender's Office?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, within Department of Administration.
Thank you.
Chairman.
We have a question from Senator Olson.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steininger, as you talked about some of the efforts to go ahead and try and establish a better retention and recruitment system, we're having particular problems with the issue up there in Atacocheview where the Manalup has been trying to go ahead and fill them, but they have no way to fill them because of some of the restrictions that are put on them. And we're making efforts now to pass legislation to make it so they can have a little more say in what goes on with some of the pay that they're having. But I was wondering, you talked about the finance. I was wondering, is there money in the budget to go ahead and specifically help the VPSO programs, or are they having particularly a lot of difficulty in recruitment and retention, or is there no financial help for the Manalup Association to try and get that? Do you understand the question?
Can you help us with that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure if I caught all of your question, but it sounded like you were asking about success and efforts for recruitment and retention of village public safety officers. Was that in the heart of the question?
Mr. Chairman, that's not the question.
Hey, could you repeat your question, please? And it's coming out a little muffled, and maybe we can crank the volume a little bit in here and go ahead and give us the question again, Senator Olson.
The question is, is there a specific amount of dollars being put in place to go ahead and try and help places that are especially hard hit by the lack of recruitment and retention? Is there money directly going specifically to those subcontracting programs?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, Do I understand the question? Are we specifically highlighting the specific subcontractors or grantees that are having the difficult, you know, a greater level of difficulty with recruitment and retention?
Yes.
That's part of it, Mr. Chairman. The main thing I'm asking for, though, is there money being put forth for recruitment and retention to those subcontractors that are out there?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the addition of money within Village Public Safety Officers is for the overall program. There's not any portion earmarked to one grantee or another. I think it might be good to get back to you in writing with a little bit more information, or have the Department of Public Safety come and talk a little bit more about the VPSO program specifically.
Okay, Senator Hoffman, and then we'll go. I know we got Senator Bishop in the queue, but on this subject, Senator Hoffman.
On this subject, I think Senator Olson referred to the restrictions that the grantees have. I've suggested for 3 years now that the department look at giving a little bit more leeway to the contractees to address recruitment, including not only the 5% increase that you are referring to, but additional flexibility on moving funds to housing, to other benefits to attract individuals, because if you do not fill those positions, and some places have as high as 30% vacancy rates, those dollars don't get spent. And when those dollars don't get spent, public safety is the one in rural Alaska that is hit the hardest. So instead of trying to be as strict as possible and trying to follow the rules to the letter of the contracts, I think that the department should be looking overall at getting services delivered to the people of rural Alaska by giving more flexibility to Manaluk and other organizations, so that they are the ones that are on the front lines out in rural Alaska and are providing the services. And if those positions aren't filled, then no matter how many new positions you add, and you can't have them filled, I don't think by adding a 5% is going to drastically reverse the trend. So the people that are out there delivering the services under the contract should have more flexibility in how those dollars get spent, as long as it shows that it is being spent on public safety. That is the core mission that needs to be addressed, and not following the restricted budgets that they have to administer. I think that's the point that Senator Olson was trying to get across. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and we'll bring that subject up when we have the department in front of us. I think those are good questions. We've had horrible issues, family issues, violent family issues around the state, and we want to try to deal with this in rural Alaska. And I'm not quite sure this does it, but we'll find out and possibly suggest some changes. Senator Bishop.
Senator Hoffman captured my comments. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Snyder, maybe this might be for the Department of Law to come in and with this presentation, but I'm a little concerned about the addressing the trial backlog, and have we put any money toward future litigation or sort of risk management to the state of Alaska by having these trial backlogs? We are denying inmates their right to a speedy trial. So I could have committed a petty theft crime, max sentence 6 months, and I could have been in there a year without being seen, and thus I would be in prison, falsely in prison, for additional 6 months, which I would be at my right to sue the state and probably would win that case. But have the Department of Law looked at some of that mitigation risk of addressing some of these trial backlogs?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'll definitely defer that question to Department of Law. But what I will point out is we are seeing, you know, budget pressures on the state side. You know, the things that are kind of more of my expertise, seeing budget pressures within Department of Corrections, with the number of people that are pre-trial and haven't gone through trial. So we are seeing, you know, symptoms of that throughout, and I think that's why you see this here, as well as the supplemental request in our fast track supplemental to try and get trials started back up as well, because there's a growing number of people in our correctional institutions that haven't underwent trial yet.
Right. And I guess just as a follow-up, and maybe this goes on to the next slide, along with this slide, is with the administration's public protection and People First initiative, does the administration project a higher number of incarcerated individuals in the state of Alaska? And if so, I don't think I saw the increase, the sort of the DOC's budget, or to help fast track the opening of Palmer Correctional, which is, I think, behind almost 2 years now.
You want to go on to the next slide? I think we're done with this slide. We'll go through this, and then we'll have some questions on this one.
Mm-hmm. So slide 12 continues on investments in public protection. So we have what's called the People First Initiative, and this is around, several different areas of public protection: domestic violence, sexual assault, missing and murdered indigenous persons, homelessness, and then as well as foster care and children's services. Within domestic violence and sexual assault, we have $3.5 million for victim services provider grants. We have $1.5 million to help reduce the turnaround time on DNA testing and increase capacity at our forensics lab. And $1 million for victim services and perpetrator intervention. Under missing and murder indigenous persons, we're establishing tribal liaisons and adding support for missing persons clearinghouse. That's about $700,000. We're also establishing a statewide homelessness coordinator, as well as a database and data manager to better track information and have more informed decisions in how the state handles issues around homelessness. And that's just shy of $900,000. We also have $1.4 million to support the Tribal Child Welfare Compact in the Office of Children's Services.
Yeah, we have questions on this slide. I think that the one bullet about the missing and murdered indigenous persons falls right into the previous slide and the issues. So we'll wrap those conversations, I think, in when we bring the Department of Law in and the Department of Public Safety. We're on to slide number 13.
On slide 13, we also have investments in resource development and the state's primacy over resources. So in the Department of Natural Resources, we're expanding the timber resource capacity. So in the 22 budget, we have a Southeast Alaska timber pilot program, and this expands that concept statewide. In the Department of Environmental Conservation, we have $5.7 million to assume primacy from the EPA for resource development permitting. So this is in two areas: the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, also commonly called RCRA, which is solid waste management. That's $830,000. And then the Clean Water Act, Section 404, this is for discharge into waterways, and that's $4.9 million. Both of these establish new units within Department of Environmental Conservation, but the hope is that with kind of a more Alaska focus on the resource development and permitting, we can disentangle this from management down south. And there's also $4 million to continue efforts at the Department of Law for cases related to, defense of statehood rights. And then in the capital budget, we have funding to develop mariculture and agriculture industries. The idea here is to enhance food security and create economic development, and that's $50 million.
It's a pretty broad definition of $50 million. We'll have to go into a little more detail with that going on coming forward. So can you come back to the committee with some information on the state of defense funds that we've already appropriated, what it's been used for, and status, and to add to your request for an additional $4 million? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somewhat related to resource development is the disasters that we have in salmon. If you are going to address this someplace else, but I believe that particularly the Chinook on the Yukon and Kuskokwim have been devastated and are at low levels, possibly on the downswing toward extinction. And I know the people on the Yukon particularly have not been able to fish for salmon, and they have gotten contributions of salmon from Bristol Bay for reds to try to supplement them. But I don't know, it seems under food security that something could be done. I know Senator Bishop has mentioned this to me numerous times, but we have prided ourselves in the state as one of the best managed states for our resources. And I feel that, unless I'm missing it, I don't see anything to try to address this most critical issue for people that utilize salmon as a primary source of sustenance in Alaska. And I know Senator Bishop and others know the importance of that resource to the state. So is it showing up someplace else, or what are we doing? It's somewhat, I bring this up at this point because I don't see it any other place in the budget.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there are a number of places in the capital budget where we have funding for Department of Fish and Game on salmon research initiatives, and I can send you a list of those capital projects. They're not operating items, and while, yes, on this slide I note some capital funding, I've been focusing primarily on the operating side, but there is some money for the Department of Fish and Game to study the issues that you're mentioning.
My question, Mr. Chairman, is it necessarily to put another report on the wall to be referred to? My question is, are we going to be putting resources, more salmon, into the streams that people can utilize in future years? This, you know, it's 5-6 years that the salmon live out in the oceans, and there are many programs throughout the world, and I know we've had them in the state of Alaska where we add more salmon. I know we spend millions of dollars putting fish into lakes so that people can go out and catch more fish for people coming to Alaska for sports. But my question is, on the ground, getting more salmon into the streams starting today, not putting more millions of dollars to put a report on the wall and ignoring the fact that our salmon industry is, particularly the Chinook, is in dire straits.
Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dovetail Senator Hoffman's comments. There's some money in the capital budget, I believe, in the 22 supplemental for fishing game, but to Senator Hoffman's point, in my opinion, it doesn't even come close to hitting the mark where we need to go, because it's a travesty what's going on the Kuskokwim, the Yukon rivers right now with the Chinook and even the Fall Chum. So we've got to fix this. We've got to put the money in it and move forward, because while we appreciate the fish being dropped off from Bristol Bay on the river, we want to catch our own fish.
Just a brief notice. Hatcheries in southeast and along the coast turned the salmon fishery around since the 70s. And if the Yukon collapses, it's going to be decades, not 2 or 3 years. So maybe the resource committee could help us a little bit with how to deal with the Yukon, and if we need hatcheries on the Yukon, or we have to convert hatcheries to salmon to get the salmon into the Yukon. But Senator Hoffman, Senator Bishop is right. We could diddly-daddle around, and we're going to lose the river.
Mr. Chairman, yes. We'll take a couple of hatcheries on the Kuskokwim, too.
Yeah, and we'll conclude the Kuskokwim, too. Starving orphans on the southern side. It's a big issue, but the concern is we start taking some affirmative action to turn it around. So Next slide, I guess.
So slide 14 is a summary of a handful of items within the operating budget that are, you know, seeking to improve the delivery of state government functions and services. We have an executive order that splits the Department of Health and Social Services into the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. And so this, you know, would really increase the ability of department leadership to focus on issues related to the divisions that split into these two new departments. Family and Community Services would focus on children's services, juvenile justice, and the 24-hour facilities. That's the Pioneer Homes and Alaska Psychiatric Institute. Department of Health would focus on public health, Medicaid, and public assistance, you know, the kind of core, the larger dollar core items that you generally think of when you think of health and social services. There is a bit of a cost to this. Just as you establish a new department, you have things like a new finance officer and a new commissioner and a new admin services director. So there is some cost there, but that, you know, provides more oversight and a lot more, you know, leadership focus to focus on delivery of the services in those divisions. And we've also transferred the public safety communications system, formerly called SATS and ALMAR, to the Department of Public Safety. This has a net zero budget impact, and that system is really better aligned with the Department of Public Safety's mission. In fiscal year 22 budget, this system is in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Prior to that, it was in the Department of Administration. When that transfer happened, you know, there were two options, Military and Veterans Affairs or Public Safety. It went to Military and Veterans Affairs, but during the transition process, it became very clear that Public Safety is really the better home from a mission standpoint. We're also transferring the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council from the Department of Fish and Game to the Department of Environmental Conservation. Currently, the chair of that council or the head of that council is the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation. And in the Department of Administration, we're making several investments into information technology. For those that have been following, may be aware there's been, you know, a lot of different cyber attacks on state government systems, most unsuccessful. Some, however, have disrupted services. So we think it's prudent to make investments into things that we're looking at as, you know, both pandemic proofing and avoiding cyber attacks. But it does add up to $28.9 million in unrestricted general fund in the capital budget. We've also restructured how costs at Department of Administration get reflected in the budget. So in your subcommittee process, you may see increments within agency budgets related to cost increases in Department of Administration. This is to reflect the costs that are billed out to those agencies for DOA functions.
Senator Wilson.
I think, Mr. Chair, just a quick question here on the Department of Administration. Does the state of Alaska have cyber insurance to help offset some of these costs from our cyber attacks?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'll have to get back to you on whether or not we have any insurance policies on that. I'm not aware of any, but that doesn't mean they don't exist.
Yeah. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the transfer of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustees Council from the Department of Fish and Game to DEC, and the commissioner, the chairman of that council is a DEC member. My question is, has the council itself weighed in on whether or not this is a good move?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, my understanding is that the council is not opposed to this move. I would have to, you know, get back to you if they've weighed in more specifically than that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can get back to us on that. That would be appreciated. Other questions on the slide? Okay, next slide.
That slide 15 is a high-level summary of statewide, what we call statewide items. These are items in the operating budget not associated with a specific state agency, often covering multiple agencies or being a, you know, cost of providing government services that can't be tied to direct operations. So here we have debt service. Traditional debt is roughly flat between fiscal year 22 and 23. However, municipal school bond debt reimbursement has increased by $59.8 million of unrestricted general fund. This represents 100% funding of the statutory obligation. In retirement assistance, there's significant reduction, $116.6 million. This is primarily a result of strong market returns for the retirement system fund, but also the choice by the ARM board not to fund the overfunded retiree health trust. That retiree health trust is currently at a funded ratio well over 100%. And so the retirement management board voted not to make a contribution to that fund this year, which saves unrestricted general fund. In fund capitalizations and transfers, there's an increase of $112 million, which primarily is from oil and gas tax credits. They're funded at the full statutory amount. In fiscal year 22, they were funded under the statutory amount, so the statutory appropriation is a significant increase. In 22, we've also made a deposit into the Disaster Relief Fund of $34 million in our supplemental budget proposal. This is continued costs from the earthquake from several years ago that are continuing to generate calls on the Disaster Relief Fund. The REAA fund is statutorily tied to the Municipal School Bond Debt Reimbursement Program, and so that is also 100% funded at $32.8 million. The change in that other row really is recategorization of costs from UGF to DGF based on conversations between OMB and Ledge Finance.
We have Senator Wilson.
I'll wait to the next slide.
Pardon me?
I'll wait to the next slide, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was watching yesterday when we were discussing the REAA fund, which was set up to build schools in rural Alaska that can't fund them or vote on them by themselves. So the Kasaili case, which was filed that put this fund forward, was a settlement. And I guess my question is, can we get an opinion from the Attorney General in out years, if we do not fully fund that settlement agreement, what liability the state of Alaska may have and may face in a court action? Because the people in rural Alaska need schools as well as those in urban Alaska. There is nothing to change the fact that urban Alaska can go ahead and vote to fund new schools without the consent of the state of Alaska, unless we put a moratorium on there. But that is not the case for those students living in Otmahluk, Kasigluk, Nunapichuk, and all the other schools in rural Alaska. So I guess I'm concerned that we are going down a path that are treating urban and rural schools differently again. This gives me great pause, and I would think that any administration would see that all of our students should be treated equally, and they should be afforded a good classroom to learn in, where snow isn't blowing under the doors and through the windows, and toilets are frozen up, and they are given a facility that they can learn in and not worry about the problems of deteriorating school. So I would ask the Attorney General to look at that, if you can request that, and give that report to the people of this committee and to the citizens of rural Alaska that are tired of being treated as second-class citizens. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if you could help the committee with that. It's been a concern over the years on this subject of school bond debt reimbursement, along with the REAA fund and the linkage. We have continually supported fully funding school bond debt reimbursement here at the committee, and funding the REAA component. And unfortunately, that hasn't prevailed in the enacted budgets. And I don't think the committee has changed its position. At least they can always, committee members can always express to me if they want the committee to shift to a different direction. But the support of fully funding school bond debt reimbursement, when it's not fully funded, falls right back to the taxpayers, property taxpayers of all the organized communities, and then rolls back into the REAA schools, and they end up coming up short, and all those kids. So when you, I'd like you to get back to the committee on a catch-up provision to hold harmless the communities around the state for school bond debt reimbursement the last few years that we have underfunded it in the enacted budget, and also the component part of the REA to bring them back up to par so the committee can see what funds have been not implemented in the enacted budget after vetoes and other negotiations to help with this policy discussion that's coming on these two subjects. So if you could help us with that background information, it'd be helpful because you'll need it in your presentation coming in the next several weeks when we have that subject in front of us. And the committee then will decide what the committee wants to do in the supplementals and the upcoming FY23 budget. And also there's concern, frankly, from a policy perspective, the legislature's never been in agreement with the administration on short funding the school bond debt reimbursement issue. And without an agreement between the legislature and the executive branch, there is no conclusion to it. So we'll continue to work on that issue. But it does not go unnoticed that in the 10-year proposed plan or financial review going forward, that the school bond debt reimbursement again goes back to 50% in FY24. And that issue is going to be of interest to all the committee members. We have other questions on this slide. We'll do the TERS and PERS here in a minute. The oil tax credits, I see, are fully funded. I think we fully funded those on the legislative side. It was not it wasn't funded, I guess, on the lack of access to the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So we'll continue with those discussions, what we want to do with that liability. Another thing I'd like to just a quick note on that subject. When we look at the revenue source book and we see the credits of the accrued liability of the tax credits that we're working here on paying off here, it's $199 million, we're at 700 balance or whatever it is, some number like that. It gets a little confusing in that when you show those credits for 23, 24, 25 fiscal years, that it's already an accrued liability versus something that's going to be accrued in 23, 24, 25. And you might want to help try to differentiate that in a footnote or something, because we had the discussion at the committee Friday on that subject, and it is confusing and not very clear to most people what is already been accrued sitting on our books that we have to pay off in a liability format versus what's going to come and be created in 23 or 24 or 25 that will then be a liability. So we need to try to parse that a little bit if we could, just for clarity, because I think our payment schedule for this will go out several years. And that's just kind of something I was thinking about the other day, that Mr. Romby, director, on how to make it easier for everybody to understand, especially people that aren't involved in it as much as the Finance Committee, that just pick up the document. Okay, we'll go on to the next slide.
So as I mentioned, there's a significant reduction in the fiscal year 23 operating budget, both in agency operations as well as in the statewide items section related to retirement contributions. There's a couple of different factors here at play. There are significant investment or significantly positive investment performance in those funds due to market conditions over the last year. There's also the decision by the ARM board to avoid an over-contribution to the health trust. That saved about $71 million. And then there's also the impacts of SB 55. That was legislation passed last year, which changes the way that we finance our retirement contributions and allows some of those costs to be shared with other fund sources. The second year of the impacts of that bill increase the savings by another $14.7 million in unrestricted general fund where we're able to shift to other fund sources. So you see the savings from the health trust and the investment performance throughout the budget in, you know, agency operations as well as the statewide item. All in, this is about $161 million savings to the bottom line.
And then how much was shifted to the federal government?
Chair Stedman, so the proportion of retirement payments within agency operations that goes to the federal government is, you know, once it's maximized, will be roughly in the order of 40%. Last year that was, you know, $100 million was shifted over, so ideally about $40 million would be shifted to the federal government. With this rate change, that $100 million went down considerably. I'm struggling to think of the exact number, but I can get that for you. But it's roughly 40% of the amount of the obligation that goes to agency operations that gets covered by the federal government.
Okay, if you can get that back to us, and there might be other questions coming here. Senator Wilson's geared up to ask a few, and Senator Bishop, because we'll have Callan, the consultant from the ARM board, in front of us coming up. And also we'll have the ARM board presentation some point. So we'll be going into this in some detail because there is, it's of interest and concern that we don't replicate the policies that were implemented back in the late 90s where TERS appeared to be overfunded. So we cut the funding in there and then it turned out to be underfunded and sunk it, and it's been underwater for over 20 years. And, you know, PERS isn't that far behind as far as a few policy mistakes like that we've made. So we want to be a little cautious that we don't replicate the errors that we've made in our past if they were done in the 90s or whenever. We just want to make sure we make a good policy call here and we get our unfunded liability behind us. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can wait till we get the ARM board and Callan in front of us to ask some of those questions, but I just fear that, you know, with the past couple of years of the pandemic, that utilization of health has been on the decline and it's so slowly starting to pick back up. So I'm just wondering if not contribution to the health trust and PERS and TERS is the best decision. So I can wait till then.
Okay. Senator Bishop.
You captured the high level of my comments. I'm going to wait for the ARM board. Myself, I just get nervous when we're avoiding over contributions.
And for that, then the under contributions of the retirement system. And we'll have a part of that discussion will be why aren't we just shifting in the funds into the underfunded portion to get that behind us.
Yep.
And I'd like to welcome Senator Wilikowski to the committee coming out of a late plane arrival. So we have done with that. We're on to slide 17.
So slide 17 I've primarily covered earlier on slide 15. But again, the school bond debt reimbursement is included at 100% of the statutory obligation, as well as the REAA fund deposit. Community assistance, similarly, is 100% of the statutory calculation. The power cost equalization fund, like other investment accounts, had very positive returns in the last year. That allows the full amount of the community assistance deposit in statute to be made. That's $30 million. There's also the full funding for oil and gas tax credits that we mentioned earlier.
So on this, I'm just curious, this is more of a structural question. You know, we're in FY22, and for those, watching at home, halfway through the year, and we had a very tight budget last winter and spring when we put the budget together, and the committee worked very hard, frankly, to get the budget to balance, have an $1,100 dividend, and not overdraw the permanent fund and meet all our obligations, including all of the requests that the governor gave in the capital budget. And pretty much, I think every request he made, the committee added. We added nothing to the budget last year. So we fast forward 6 months or so, just rounded off, and we've had, for the revenue side, a fortunate expansion in the oil price, which gave us some breathability in the FY22 budget. So why are we not going back into this current year, for example, like the school bond debt reimbursement, and fully funding FY22 with the additional revenue that's coming in between now and June, along with dealing with revenue sharing for communities, and also why aren't we looking at proposals to put back some of the monies that we took out of some of our savings components, because we diminished them to the minimum, just getting out of here 6 months ago, leaving us in a very precarious position if oil prices were to decline. They happened to increase, so we got lucky. So can you help the committee with why we're not taking a look at replacing these funds that we took out of a lot of these areas, or short-funded some of these areas like revenue sharing and school bond debt reimbursement and the REA funds?
Yes, Chair Stedman. So yes, we do have a much better revenue picture now than we did when the fiscal year 22 budget was enacted. There's significant increase in projected fiscal year 22 budget and actual collections over the course of this year. If you look at the fiscal year 22 budget proposal, once accounting for completing the 50-50 dividend payment and a handful of targeted investments in the capital budget, there's about $170 million based on the December 15th revenue projections left. That money would be swept into the CBR to accomplish that, a bit of that need to rebuild savings that you mentioned. So there is, while it is a much better revenue outlook than we had when the fiscal year 22 budget was passed, it's not enough to meet every single one of those needs. So that $170 million going into the CBR helps to rebuild some of those savings balances and ensure that money is available in the future. But then looking at our 23 budget, we have, less money based on the December 15th projections and surplus, about $27 million. That also would go into the CBR. But it was in the 23 budget that we looked at the available revenues to accomplish, fully funding some of these things. While we weren't able to do it in both years and make deposits into savings, we were at least able to fully fund some of these obligations in fiscal year 23.
Okay. I think the committee will take a look at that, FY22, and the revenue changes, and what's wasn't funded in the budget, and the depletion of all our different savings components. putting the last several budgets together. My concern is 177, or you can call it 200 million. We have difficulty even getting that close in our revenue projection sometimes. And supplementals sometimes are in the 60, 70, 80 million dollars, $90 million supplemental budgets. And the concern is that we don't put the next legislature a year from now, and the next administration, could be the current governor, could be the new governor, in a position where all of the savings is totally depleted and there isn't the revenue, recurring revenue, to pay the recurring expenditures. And we're going to be looking at what the picture looks like if we have $60 or $65 or $55 a barrel oil, or $50 a barrel oil. And where are we? Clearly, 200 million sounds like a big number, but when you look at our burn rate the last several years, it's a drop in the bucket. We burned through $16 billion the last half a dozen or plus years. So there is concern that that savings component that this committee has spent many, many hours on over the last 20 years and put the state in a position of having roughly $18 billion set aside to weather this last storm that we didn't know was coming or how severe it was going to be. You know, clearly, most of us are aghast that we burned through that much savings that short of time, but we did. We, you know, that whole discussion isn't even being reflected in any of the budgetary documents I've seen. And Senator Hoffman has a question. He was here at the table through the whole cycle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a reminder to the audience out there that the administration proposes a budget. We dispose of the budget. We are the appropriators. We decide what gets to the governor's office. The administration has an obligation under law to present a budget to this committee, but as appropriators, we decide if we want to put these numbers back into a supplemental or not. And I would agree with the chairman that this committee should give it due diligence regarding particularly the municipal bond indebtedness, the rural school construction, and the community assistance program, so that those are three areas that municipalities are directly affected, and again, we appropriate, the administration does not.
Okay. Any other questions on this? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I'm just curious, in the last couple of years, when we've had deficits there, was the oil and gas credits proposed to be funded fully by the governor?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, last year we included the statutory amount in budget amendments. In other years, while we were waiting the outcome of the court case related to the concept around financing that debt, we held off on introducing appropriations for it until the outcome of that court case.
Okay. I think what we can do then to help refresh everybody's memory, when we go back and we take a look at the municipal bond debt reimbursement, REA, and other things, we'll take a look at the history of the tax credits the last several years, Senator Wilikowski, refresh everybody's memory, what was proposed, what was enacted in that balance on that subject. Yes, follow up.
I'm just curious why last year, for example, the oil and gas credits were proposed to be funded at the statutory amount, which is discretionary, while the school debt bond reimbursement, for example, was a mandatory statute, the REA statute, I believe, is mandatory. Also, the community assistance deposit. Why did the administration believe it was important to fully fund the oil and gas tax credits last year fully, but not the others, which are statutorily supposed to be funded?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, those two decisions aren't necessarily tied to each other. You know, each budget item is kind of independently considered based on overall resources and what the you know, the impacts of the decision on the long-term outlook of the state. With oil and gas tax credits, you know, because appropriations hadn't been made while the state was waiting on the outcome of that court case, you know, once that outcome came, it was clear we needed to start, you know, paying down that obligation, since the alternative method of paying it, you know, wasn't, you know, was deemed inappropriate by the courts. School bond debt reimbursement, you know, there were pragmatic decisions made regarding available revenues to different communities, you know, through the significant amount of federal COVID relief that came in, being part of the decision in 1 year. This year, as we're fully funding it, we're really looking at this as a way to provide relief to municipal property taxpayers, because ultimately they're the ones who benefit from the payment of this debt reimbursement, because if the state doesn't kick in, it does create more of a pressure on those property taxpayers. So because there's available revenue here in fiscal year 23, you know, we see an opportunity to provide that relief. But those decisions are, you know, made independently of each other.
That goes into my earlier question. There's available revenue in 22 also. We have other questions on 17 before we zip on to 19, or excuse me, 18. Okay, we'll go into COVID relief.
So slide 18 is to try and give a summary of the roughly $504 million in remaining available money from the Community, State, and Local Fiscal Relief Fund through the American Rescue Plan Act. So this is the portion of that act that is fully discretionary. When we're using it just for revenue replacement, we treat it in the budget just like unrestricted general fund. This ensures that there's not a inconsistencies in reports year over year as we use this money as UGF revenue. But that's not the only place that we've used in the budget. We also have included $20 million for public health response, $37.4 million in targeted investments in the operating budget. These are, you know, one-time investments for workforce development, economic development within the University of Alaska, domestic violence and sexual assault victim services. This is related to what's called VOCA. There was a kind of federal disruption in the funding that came in, and we have been backfilling that. Fiscal year 23 should be the last year needed to backfill it, as there is a federal solution there. We also have about $1 million for DNA collection activities at the Department of Corrections. This one, while it is a one-time use of the money, that activity will continue, so you'll see some support for that in next year's budget. There's also what's called the Coronavirus Capital Project Fund. This is discretionary but has a lot more rules around it. It's money for projects that enhance health, education, and remote work, so distance opportunities for health, education, and remote work, as well as support for community centers. So we've allocated $64 million of this, but there's $47.9 million remaining to allocate. These do require appropriations, and you'll see those three projects in the capital budget, and we'll go into more detail when we have a presentation on capital.
Senator Bishop.
Mr. Steininger, is that part of the 100, the 64 and the 47? Are you counting that as the 111 that we had left to allocate? Is that the pot of money?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, it's a little over $111 million in the Coronavirus Capital Project Funds, yes.
And initial follow-ups?
Right.
And initially, or a year ago, that was highlighted as broadband investment, and those grants had to go to the Treasury Secretary for approval. It's come to my attention. It seems like we've got some further guidance where we might have some leeway. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct. Initial reads of the guidance indicated that might be broadband only. However, you know, as the Treasury released more guidance, it opened up to more than just broadband projects.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, these are discretionary funds, and food security is an allowable expenditure. I'm wondering if the administration could take a second look at the collapse of Chinook in the state of Alaska, and is there any way that they can support something that would put more salmon into the streams? I think that if people of Alaska were asked the question, is that as important or more important than drone research, I'm sure you'd get a 90% response saying that putting more salmon into the streams to feed Alaskans is more important than researching drones. There's throughout the world, there's millions, if not billions of dollars going into drone research. And we're facing critical devastation of stocks on the Kuskokwim and Yukon. It was pointed out to me that there also has been, for the first time, a major reduction in chum salmon in Alaska streams as well. So if the administration could take a second look at that, I would request that because it's hard to go forward with something even if we put it into the budget and it does not get implemented by the administration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Snyder, can you give us basically a better scorecard on some of the COVID funding and some of the fund sources that's left? And did the guidance change to any of the dedicated funds, which were solely sort of within the administration's purview? Did any of those guidance change that gave more flexibility to the funding? And if so, where? And could we also get a list of some of those funds that the guidance were a little bit more flexible that would have given the legislature a little bit more appropriating authority to appropriate those funds?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, we can certainly give you a list, a comprehensive list of all the grants that came in through the various COVID relief acts, and updates on where those are at. I definitely can't speak for every single one because it's hundreds, but I know guidance has been refined on all of those programs over time and pretty regularly. In fact, one program, we had guidance revised a week before the end date of the program. And so it's been definitely a learning experience as we work through those.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my concern was based off of some other states' lawsuits and the last sort of the State Officers Association meeting that some of the guidances were changed that allowed a lot more flexibility in some of the use of the funding that the states received, and just didn't know if we have a list of those programs that would have given the state our appropriation authority over some of those funds. So just trying to get a list of some of those funds.
Okay. If you can help us with that, we'll be going into this in quite a bit of detail, both operating and capital coming forward. I think it's going to consume a good portion of our time. So back to an earlier subject, how do we not position the future legislatures and future governors in a precarious position where they are unable to meet the budgetary obligations they face at the time. And that is a concern with the FY22 and the FY23 budget as presented to this committee. It leaves the future looking bleak. And if we don't take the opportunity to try to increase our savings position, it's going to be very difficult when those days come, and they're going to come fairly quickly. So when we look at the federal relief money, has there been consideration given by the administration to backfill some of this with our general fund monies that we've created with some of this relief money and postponing these expenditures of funds into the future, FY24, FY25? While FY22 is still open, we have the ability to do some adjustments to to put the future governor, the next governor, could be the current one or someone else, no one knows, in legislature. Some of us will be back, some of us won't. But it will give them savings component that we do know, or that we no longer have because we've depleted them. Can you help me and the committee understand that issue a little bit? And I'll be asking the Ledge Finance the same question.
Yes, Chair Stedman. So the way that we look at and think about the $1 billion of community, state, local fiscal relief funds that came into the state through ARPA, $500 million of which was used in the fiscal year 22 budget and $500 million of which we're using here. When you look at that money coming to the state and the, you know, the guidance from the federal government, it effectively acts as unrestricted general fund. And so you can kind of think of this as unrestricted general fund revenue to the state. And when you look at the budget that we put together for fiscal year 23 and released on December 15th, and the other revenues available to the state that were, you know, known on December 15th, using the $375 million in revenue replacement, you know, helped us to, you know, using all the different revenue tools to balance our budget. So, you know, there is no doubt that that revenue is being used to help balance the state's budget. Since then, you know, Department of Revenue has released updated revenue forecasts, and, you know, we'll see where that goes. If there's additional unrestricted general fund revenues available to allow us to balance the budget in 23, you know, some of this federal money could be used differently. But effectively, no matter how you use this federal money, you should think of it as unrestricted general fund because it can be used as unrestricted general funds. So we did use more to balance budget as revenue replacement than was used last year. $250 million was used in that manner last year, and $250 million used for direct appropriations. But even when you think about those direct appropriations, you should think of them as unrestricted general fund appropriations because effectively they are. And so when you look at the things that we're doing here, you know, they're really focused on, you know, the values the administration wanted to put into our budget. You know, pandemic health response and finishing up the work necessary there, investment in the state's workforce and industry, you know, investment in sexual assault and domestic violence issues. And then in the capital budget, a lot of capital investments in, you know, workforce development, in development of industry, and things of that nature. This, you know, yes, next year we won't have access to this money. You know, in future years we won't have federal relief coming in that acts as unrestricted general fund. And, you know, in future years there will always be budget challenges that we have to face and work through. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't use the federal revenues that are available today to help benefit the state, both through balancing our budget and making strategic investments.
Yeah, I would agree with your last comment, but I, as I recall, I think we have till December 24 on some of these funds. Is that not correct, that we can do some, if we decided to, do some budgetary adjustments to have some of this, these funds available out beyond 23, is that correct?
Chair Stedman, the eligibility date for this money is December 31st of 2024. So it could be extended forward further if there's available general fund revenues to support some of these costs, because again, it's effectively just unrestricted general fund revenue to the state.
So the reason I bring this up to the committee members is the Finance Committee many years ago took a very firm position on saving and increasing the savings position of the state, the liquidity position of the state. Happened to end up being in the billions. We had no idea how much it was going to be when we started. I think when we first started, we We were looking at 30, 40, 50 million paying off a few things here and there, and it went up as revenue went up. And I think we need to have that discussion at the table again, because we, FY24 and FY25, FY26 are just around the corner. And we have depleted our liquidity position to the bare minimum, as we talked about yesterday, if we take out the $400 million into the education fund and not count it in the CBR. And even a $1.4 billion CBR balance, when we run deficits, gets depleted extremely quickly, and we're going to be having stress testing going on, and that'll be very apparent to the committee. As a reminder, they already know, because we've all sat here and watched billions flow out of savings to keep a balanced budget over the next several years. And I think we need to look further forward than FY23. And we're fortunate today to have higher oil prices, and we may not be so fortunate 6 months from now, or a year from now, or 2 years from now. And if we don't take advantage of this, we're going to walk our state into significant taxes and huge deficits and drawdowns of other areas that we don't want to draw down, because we won't have no choice. So I think that so we'll have the conversation with Ledge Finance on what's some of our options. And I think one of the options of setting money aside is to move some of this federal money receipts, if we convert it to GF or do all our magical accounting maneuvers, into 2024. The other thing that I'd like the committee to think about when we talk about the savings components is we can also forward fund education. This committee was adamant about it several years ago, well over a decade, when we started forward funding education. And we ended up forward funding it through the work of the entire legislature for a year in advance. That is a component part of you know, a savings, and it is non-sweepable. So I'd like to have you work with the committee over the next several months on all the options available to us. As Senator Hoffman reminded the committee, we're the appropriators, and we need the options available to us on the table to make that policy discussion and make the policy call. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's another option, and for decades, when under the old ELF tax structure we had, we had a constant 12.5% tax, and combined with our 12.5% royalty, which basically provided a pretty stable, a relatively stable amount. Of course, oil prices went up and down, but when we passed ACES back in 2007 or 2008, we had this exact discussion, Mr. Chairman. You and Senator Hoffman were chairing this committee, and we made what I think was the very wise decision to say, well, oil prices go up and down; they fluctuate tremendously. And you can either have a policy that gets you a relatively stable amount, or you can have a policy that gets you a high amount at very high oil prices. You share in the windfall, and a lower amount at lower prices. And that's what we did. And that's when we saved $18 billion. And then when times went tough, we used that money. But now we have a policy where at oil, it's $88 a barrel. We're barely balancing our budget. Actually, we're not even balancing our budget if you take away the federal funds and you take away the permanent fund. So we've adopted a policy as a state where we just barely balance the budget, if not at extremely high oil prices. And then when prices go down, we're stuck. We have nothing. And so I think there needs to be a reevaluation of our the value that we're getting for our resources, because we're not getting anywhere near. Is the administration looking at that at all?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'll have to defer you to the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Well, we'll be asking the commissioner. She's been requested by a couple of the committee members to come before the committee for several questions. So we can relay that to her, because I think what Senator Wilkowski might be referring to is we've heard discussions that they did have a tax bill in the works last year, never seen the light of day or what have you, but we'll get an update from the department. And we have one more slide. Slide number 19. The one you've been looking for since Friday morning at 9 o'clock.
Yes, last slide. The Federal Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act was enacted on November 15th, 2021. And I'd like to make a pretty clear distinction between this and the prior federal COVID relief bills. This really is not a relief bill in the nature that ARPA or CARES was. This is really a reauthorization of a lot of existing federal programs, addition of new federal programs, most with five-year time horizons. It's not a relief package for states. There's not a large sum of discretionary money coming to the state through this bill. There's a lot of programs and programmatic work within agencies, some of which is very new and needs some understanding and some action by the state of Alaska in order to apply or capture these funds. But just generally, it's a five-year reauthorization. A lot of the program details are pending. We don't have guidance on many. And there will be budget impacts, but you won't see many of them in the budget that we put forward on December 15th, really just the rural ferry programs, which, as noted earlier, isn't the only portion in that bill for the ferries. But some of these impacts, just as we get more information, we'll be releasing budget amendments or briefing the committee and committee members on them and how they interact with the state budget and if there's match requirements or anything of that nature.
Could you remind the committee when the deadline is for amendments?
Yes, Chair Stedman. So the deadline for budget amendments statutorily is the 30th day of legislative session. And so we'll have an amendment package then, but we likely won't have a lot of guidance from the federal partners on some of these programs at that time for every one of the programs. More information comes out on a near daily basis.
Okay, so you'd like us to consider amendments beyond the statutory deadline?
Chair Stedman, that likely in order to accommodate some of the items in this infrastructure bill would likely be necessary. But as we get more information, we'll be briefing the legislature on that.
Okay. There's a couple questions on the table here. Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one program that hasn't been listed here but is very important to the people of Alaska is broadband. And there's going to be tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars being spent to bring fiber to many parts of Alaska. And I know that of all of the programs that are out there, that is probably one of the most significant changes that people in rural Alaska are going to see, to be able to get 5G, which Anchorage gets now, but rural Alaska does not even get close to that. So I'll be following that item very closely, and I think other people of this committee will also want to give that some special attention, because it can change the way people in rural Alaska live with access to broadband.
Okay. Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is more upon maybe the combination of this these funds and the ARPA funds in terms of the classifications of UGF funds. It just seems that we're just sort of masking sort of the backfill, and just didn't know if OMB or maybe our alleged finance folks could have a different classification of these temporary federal funds to help distinguish some of the backfill funding that we're using for our state budget, just for transparency purposes.
So. Mr. Steininger, can you help us and explain to the public how your office and legislative finance work together to ensure that we have clarity within our accounting process, and how we sometimes create new fund codes and when we create them so we can always go back and unwind things and look at things historically. Can you help us with that?
Yes, thank you, Chair Stedman and Senator Wilson. So normally federal receipts come in under a single, what we call a fund code or a revenue source in the state's budget. And there's normally just one general category that's just federal receipts. However, last year, as we were looking at a multitude of different federal relief bills, with all sorts of acronyms, CARES, CERSA, ARPA, there were quite a few different sources of revenue that were all interplaying in different ways with different eligibility criteria, some of which could offset general fund spending. And so working with legislative finance and the finance committees, we created different fund codes to track those different revenue sources. So in our state budget reports, you can see where money from the CERSA relief bill is being used or the ARPA relief bill is being used. There's even distinction between where it's being used as revenue replacement to offset an unrestricted general fund cost or a direct use. So there are tools within the budget to categorize that. It gets into a pretty weedy technical space within our budget reports, but that detail is there for us to report on. When we look at the Federal Infrastructure and Investments in Jobs Act, some of these things, they're reauthorizations of existing programs like surface transportation at DOT, where, it's a program that's been around for a long time. It's not something new. It may just be getting more money. So we may not create a new fund code for that just out of the infrastructure bill, but there may be some areas where, there's revenue replacement being utilized that may be a new fund code, and that tracking detail is necessary.
Thank you.
On slide 19, could you help me with your second to last bullet where it says, Marine Highway to preserve basically the cash box? What concepts is the administration working on to preserve and move forward the cash box from fiscal year to fiscal year?
Yes, Chair Stedman. So that bullet I addressed a little bit earlier. There's the Rural Ferry Program, which is what we're using to support the operating costs of the ferry system in the budget. That Rural Ferry Program appears to be able to cover all the unrestricted general fund costs for a 12-month operation, as well as the use of designated general funds, the Marine Highway System receipts. And so that would allow us to both preserve UGF in the operating budget, but also have the Marine Highway System bank those fare box recoveries. If this program only lasts the 5 years that are there, the system would come out of that with a significant amount of fare box collections. There's still, transition and change. You referenced the new board that oversees Marine Highway System. There's transition and change necessary for the system. So we can't take our eyes off of that. This federal money coming in really needs to be treated as the, providing us the room and the flexibility to improve the system, and not just, allow it to stay in the status quo just because there's now a lot of, federal money coming in and it's not the same state dollar budget concern that it used to be. There's still a lot of, room for transition for a system that better serves the needs of coastal communities.
So I shouldn't then assume that where it says preserve unrestricted general funds that the cash box is going to be preserved. It's going to be revenue is going to be generated by ticket sales, and it'll be absorbed into the Marine Highway and operating expenses. And then the normal subsidy that we've put in every year since creation of it, then would just, it's not going to be set aside. Is that correct? That normal subsidy, if it's 50 million, say target a number, 60, whatever, pick a number. It's not going to go into a sinking fund for future use. It's going to be, what's going to happen to it?
Chair Stedman, the roughly $63 million in unrestricted general fund savings just go to reduce the total need for unrestricted general funds in the state operating budget. They're not being, rediverted to any other funds specifically. So that's still you know, the banking of the fare box recovery or the, you know, saving for a future system is something yet to be determined. What you see in the budget here is simply just the use of that rural ferry program.
My concern, or one of my concerns, is, and even at the local level, when you free up, like in this case, say just use 65 million, 60 million, doesn't really matter. You free that up and you, from, in this case, the Marine Highway, you take it into the general fund, it gets absorbed into the other services that the state requires. There's more needs than there are funds, and that is true every single year. And we have to prioritize what we're gonna fund, and we produce a budget. So over the next 5 years, the system will then consume that 60 million plus into its base. At the end of the 5 years, when the Marine Highway comes back and needs 60 million to operate, there are 60 million other mouths that have been fed. And that's the concern of a crowding out effect. So we've got to have some policy discussions on how we're going to deal with that. It would be very difficult in that year, year five or year six, for the Marine Highway to sit at the end of the table and say, we want a new appropriation for $80 million or $70 million to operate. So that is a concern. I just want to make sure the people at home understand that that money, the 60 some odd million, is going to be consumed for other worthy needs around the state. It could be education, it could be, you know, public safety, could be fish and game, could be all kinds of things. And I've never seen government not free up money and then not have a crowding out effect when it comes back. So there's always a first, but I wouldn't hold my breath on this one. So anyway, we'll work on that when we deal with the Marine Highway, and I don't have an answer to it. It's just a concern, significant concern. I don't want to have the Marine Highway implode in 5 years because of the way we structure it. We have any other questions on slide 19? That concludes OMB. I appreciate the office and all your staff putting documents together, coming forward. Mr. Steininger, you in particular, for having to sit at the hot seat for 2 days and explain the budget, and then we'll go through and, you know, have further dialogue going forward as we make our adjustments. So on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank OMB for all their hard work. And with that, we're going to take a brief at ease. We'll come back on the record. Thanks, everybody, for sticking around here till the end. We're going to adjourn the meeting here in a minute. And what we'll do, because we're hoping to have, normally it takes OMB one meeting or a meeting in a few minutes or the following one, but this year it took two full meetings for OMB, and that's fine. We're going to take Ledge Finance and move them down the calendar in the morning until they we get them fitted in. Tomorrow we have Callan, I think. So, when they come in from out of town, so we'll have to deal with those type of travel issues. And then we'll bring OMB back, but Ledge Finance in to go over the budget as soon as we can, hopefully day after tomorrow or tomorrow, whatever. But we're going to hold budgetary meetings in the morning and legislation in the afternoon. So if we run long on our portion in the morning, we'll just continue to push it back. And I don't think it matters when. It's not time critical for Ledge Finance to be here tomorrow morning. Is what I'm saying. It's early in the process, and it's not going to slow us down. I would rather us have thorough meetings than rush things, and we'll still be done on time. So with that, we'll see everybody this afternoon, 1 p.m. Senator Bishop will be working the committee. We are adjourned.